which will come up in a moment. It's a real pleasure to have Liz with us. She's a staunch supporter of Christians in Science, and you'll hear all about her career and so on in a moment. But she graduated in chemistry at Brunel University in 1983, and then began her career in the analytical instrument business. She started work with a large American multinational, and then she was transferred to the US for 4 years in the 90s before moving back to the UK with her husband in 1997. And I think she'll tell you much more about this, but this is just to put the picture. And involved in setting up their own specialist instrument company. Liz has been a committed Christian since childhood, and she continues to work as a company director 3 to 4 days a week. But she now enjoys time with her large family, contributing where she can to the better understanding of science within the church community. And hot off the press, it's coming out in the beginning of June, I hope she'll say more about that, has written this children's book on science and faith, God's Cosmic Cookbook. And it's being published by Hodder and Stoughton. So she didn't, unfortunately, have any copies to be able to bring tonight, but you can get them on Amazon. It should be great for young people, particularly. So without further ado, let me introduce Liz to you. Great to have you with us, and we'll be having some questions afterwards, I'm sure, Liz. Thanks.
I'm going to be talking about a life in the scientific business, in a business that's surrounded by science. So it might be a bit of a change from a lot, you know, we do research, our very livelihoods depend on it, but it's a very different sort of environment to a university or teaching environment. Okay, so I just want to begin with a very quick potted history. And my system shows me the slide before. Right, so I want to start with the things that I would say have shaped my life, or I should really say that God has used to shape my life, because that's how I see it as a Christian. So the first major event is about age 11, I was converted. So I became a Christian when I was 11. It's a whole story, as always, for that. And I didn't go to a church-going family, not really. They certainly weren't committed Christians. In fact, my father had very definitely wandered away from the faith before I was born. So my biggest witness is that once you become a Christian, God doesn't let you go. Thank God he doesn't let you go, and that's fantastic. But that definitely shaped the rest of the course of my life. The next thing that probably all of us would say, and if I say I started at 22, is that all right? Okay, I'm going to try not to overtalk because I understand we can outstay our welcome here. And I don't want to do that. Right, I'll do my best. Okay, like all of us probably, I owe so much to a wonderful, inspirational teacher at school. And in my case, it was a chemistry teacher called Mr. Sadler. And, you know, if it hadn't been for Mr. Sadler, I thought I was going to do biology. So I could have, you know, heaven only knows what I would have ended up doing. But Mr. Sadler really inspired me with chemistry. And that definitely set the course of my career. The next sort of major milestone is my choice of degree. So this, you might think, what's that got to do with a chemistry degree? But I chose to do a sandwich course. I chose to do a thin sandwich course, which is where Brunel University came in. It's not a famous institution. But when I, you know, back in 1979, when I was looking, it was the only university. It was a science university, predominantly engineering, but with all the sciences. But it did what's called a thin sandwich course, which meant that for each four-year course, for each of the first 3 years, the autumn term and spring term was at university, the summer term and vacation period were at work. And you could do three different jobs. And honestly, it was a fantastic decision. It was a great decision. I learned so much from those three periods in work. So my lessons learned. I'll read these because I'm sorry it is a bit small. All right, so the thing I learned, the first one I worked for was an analytical instrument company. And I loved it. I loved the teamwork, I loved the energy, I loved the drive, I loved the passion for what they were doing, for moving the frontiers of analysis along. People underestimate the importance of, so often, of getting the measurement right. Well, analytical chemists don't. So I loved it. My next job was in cancer research, and I thought I'd love it. I absolutely thought I'd love it. I went to the Gray Laboratory at Mount Vernon, prestigious cancer research lab, and I learned the sad truth about research is that until you have about three postdocs under your belt, you are a technician cog very often in a great big wheel. But the other disappointing thing is this was a particularly challenging time for academia, and the competition to make sure you got the next round of funding was such that it was very negative because people defended their own work and wouldn't share because they had to get the papers out. And so having come from a very cooperative environment in industry, I found that so disappointing. I hope it's not familiar to any of you today, but that's how it was, and I'm afraid it really disappointed me. Then I worked, bear in mind I was about 22 by this stage, and I worked for the Met Lab in London in the drugs section. So this involved all sorts of interesting samples that the Metropolitan Police brought in, having six of them arrested, one poor suspect, and fished all sorts of things out from his clothing and so on. Then we got to test it, and it should have been routine. We were doing the same tests every day on these different samples, but it was again great. It was a great team. Great learning experience, but I did learn never, ever, ever commute to central London. I chose 6 months when British Rail went on strike for 2 weeks, closely followed by London Underground. And it was one of only three times, I think, in history when London was gridlocked, completely gridlocked, and people literally were sleeping at the lab. So, the other thing it was a sobering lesson about working for the civil service, because I learned that to go for promotion, however good you were at your job, you needed this kind of firing squad arrangement of an interview, and I was a scared, probably 21-year-old, and I didn't like the idea of that. So, what did this teach me? Well, I did very well at university. I won the prize in the end for the top of the year. So, yes. So I was really pleased, and I got several PhD offers, none of which, I have to say, really motivated me. But my learning from the sandwich course was that what I loved was the sharp end of scientific business. That's what I love, the mix of commerce and science. And I didn't need a PhD to do that. And the only reason I was considering it is because I quite fancied being called Dr. Wolfenden. And that I then thought, well, that's not a good enough reason to spend my parents' money for the next three years, especially seeing I wasn't really motivated. So, I'm not Dr. Cole. I'm so sorry. I did try and say, I'm not. I'm here under false pretenses. I'm just Elizabeth Cole, was Elizabeth Wolfenden at the time. And so I chose instead to go straight to work, if you like, to work in terms of business. And I got a job. You're going to love this. My title was Thermal Desorption Product Specialist. Which actually has, again, been the big, guess what I am still, really, a thermal desorption product specialist. And you'll see why I love it, I hope, in a minute. But basically, it's a very specialist niche. Do have any of you heard of gas chromatography? Okay, lovely. So I'll talk a tiny bit about it later, so don't worry if it's news. But thermal desorption is basically a very specialist component that can go at the front end of gas chromatography. So gas chromatography is a niche, GCMS is a niche, gas chromatography mass spec. Thermal desorption is a niche of a niche. And so it was my job to know everything about it. And then the salespeople, who were all very specialist themselves, the technical sales team, real experts in GC, GCMS, if they had somebody who wanted to know more about thermal desorption, they would call me in, or to run the samples, or to whatever. So, I'm going to whiz through this. Basically, I've got some bits here. So, if I pass these round, maybe you'd be kind enough to... I'm going to show you some pictures, but I think actually having the things in your hand. It's inside that tube, and then these are the samples. So what you basically do, usually, 80% of the time, is you have a tube that size, and it's full of adsorbent material. So it works a bit like a cooker hood. You pull air through it, and you might pull a balloon full of air through it, and then you concentrate it and selectively inject it into the GC. I'll show you how it works. Okay. So this is what the system looks like, and to get the hang of this bit is here. See on the other side? Is there and there. And then going round is the much thinner tubes, which are quartz and fragile, as she says, with a capital F. So be careful. Although these are, I think they're probably, they only gave me, you know, what I mean. That goes in here in the middle. Okay, that's the focusing trap. Notice how much smaller it is. So what you do is you heat this up and you pass inert gas through it. Okay? So normally people think of extraction as using a liquid to wash stuff off. You know, you would extract a soil, or you would extract a plant. You would extract the things you're interested in. But if you imagine a balloon full of air that you have pumped through this, maybe 100 litres. If you heat this up and pass an inert gas through it afterwards, you could get all the organic chemicals, so all the volatile organic chemicals and semi-volatile organic chemicals, back off again in about a cupful. And then that cupful of gas goes on to the little trap in the middle. Okay? And then the valve moves and the gas then goes through that little tiny trap and it heats at 100 degrees a second. So then all those vapors that were in this balloon and then in the cup come off in about 200 microliters of gas. So what you've effectively done is you've concentrated in two steps by about a million. So now the GC and the MS stand a chance of being able to measure your analysis. And that sort of cartoon at the right of the slide, that's a chromatogram. That's a gas chromatogram. So what can you do with it? Well, it's used for all sorts of very low-level toxic and smelly chemicals. And I'm going to show you some. So the first one I've got on this slide is explosives. Okay, now they are pretty toxic in all sorts of ways. And it's a testament to the development of the technology that I've been involved in, that you can actually, this is a thermal desorption technique, so heat is part of it, but you can still get explosives through. It's so inert now. Here's another one, sulfur compounds. You know the smell of boiling cabbage. You know the smell if you open the dog food and you leave it open for too long. You know the smell of driving past a sewage farm on a hot day. Those are all thiols, sulfides, and smelly chemicals. So this thermal desorption technology with GCMS is used to monitor and measure these sorts of chemicals. Here's a real landfill sample. Look how many chemicals are coming out of it. Every single blip is a separate chemical. And you can see why you need the mass spectrometer. Basically, the GC separates all the peaks, and the detector, the mass spectrometer, tells you what they are. Okay? So you concentrate, separate, identify, and measure. That's the whole process. So this is a real photograph, and it is probably the scariest slide I've got. So those are all drums of VX nerve agent in a stockpile in the US, and there are similar stockpiles all over the world. Now, because, thank God, of the OPCW, treaties that everyone has signed to destroy and get rid the world of these terrible things, they are being destroyed in chemical processes all over the world, and the whole thing is being audited by The Hague, OPCW. I can't remember all that stands for. But of course, somebody's got to guard these facilities. Somebody's got to run the chemical processing plant. So monitoring these chemicals is very important. Here's the sort of screening run they do for live agent. So this is for the various, do you remember the attack on the Tokyo subway? Well, that was the first blip on the chromatogram, that was sarin. And a lot of people died because they didn't have the analytical test ready, handy, to be able to identify which agent was being used so they couldn't give the right antidote in time. So there's also a bit of I quite like this, the two peaks at the end, which are the VX. You won't be close enough, you won't see this on the screen. But this one is VX, real VX. That one, the Russians didn't have VX, so they wanted to synthesize some. It's very close, but it's different, and it's called Russian VX. It's just equally nasty. Right. So, on a more mundane, but nevertheless more relevant to most of us, thank goodness again, are persistent organic pollutants that are in the environment. So these are PCBs that are formed from transformer oils, PAHs, you get from the heavy bits of fuel, fossil fuels, coal. Stack testing. Now, most stacks are monitored using continuous monitors for the things that they're emitting, but if it's very toxic, you need specialist technology like ours. Incidentally, as a little bit of general knowledge I picked up, if you go past an industrial plant and the stack is very high, that costs a lot of money to build a high stack, and it means that whatever's being emitted is toxic, because it obviously gets better dispersed. So the higher the stack, the more toxic, as a general rule. Okay, I'm going to keep going. All right, this is a very pretty chromatogram. These are the volatile chemicals that they monitor around industrial sites, everywhere from China to Chicago. They're monitoring, you know, everyone's got to stop producing CFCs, stop producing the various chemicals that cause that damage cause the hole in the ozone layer, as well as greenhouse gases. So these chemicals are critical. They're all volatile, chlorinated or fluorinated compounds or solvents. And so you get some interesting things that you find. It's amazing what gets emitted at 2 a.m. But now with the continuous monitors, they are better at catching people out if they do. Right. This is again a bit close to home sometimes. Now this, I stress, was 20 years ago. All of a sudden, the car industry was confronted by the fact that whereas in a workplace environment, you have fit and healthy adults as a general rule, by definition, inside a car will go newborn babies, elderly people, people with health problems. And this was the atmosphere. This was inside you can see I was in America when I wrote this, about a regular car. So this is an ordinary little saloon car at ambient temperature. And the total here is 3.7 parts per million. The examples I've shown you just gone were parts per billion, 1,000 times lower, or in the case of the agent, parts per trillion. So this, to be honest with you, 3.7 ppm is a factory level. Probably be okay in a factory because it's safe for everybody. It's not safe if you're less than a week old. And of course, if you park a car in the sun, this is only 40 degrees, the level triples. Now, the car industry have taken huge note of this, and I have to say that if you tested a car now, it would be at least 10 times lower. Okay, at least 10 times lower. Because they've had to. Their customers won't stand for this kind of pollution anymore. People used to say they love the new car smell. And everybody used to think that the smear on the windscreen, inside the windscreen, was from the bus in front. It's not actually, it's from the dashboard. It's from the seats of the car. And as you get, the moral of this 20 years ago was buy a second-hand car. That was the moral. Okay, another interesting one is breath testing. So here's one of the breath. Anyone guess what this is used for? It says on the slide. So this was developed by the UK Health and Safety Executive. No, this alcohol is so easy because you're only looking for ethanol. You don't need our kind of fancy equipment. They do use a different related technique, but it's easy routine stuff. So this is used for people who are at work and dealing with chemicals that they don't inhale, they absorb through the skin. And then the human being effectively is the sampler to check they're not exposed to too much. You have to take a blood sample, a urine sample, or get them to breathe out. because the alveolar air at the bottom of the lungs is in partition, it's in equilibrium with the blood concentrations. So the HSC invented this, you blew through it and then you pushed the breath sample onto the sampling tube. And you could actually measure, and the other people at work it was used for was people wearing protective equipment, because there's no real way of proving it's working other than testing the human being. But the most interesting and widespread use it has now is for disease diagnosis research. So we are biochemical factories, the byproducts of volatile chemicals. People will tell you somebody with diabetes, you can smell acetone on their breath. People with kidney failure, you can smell ammonia on their breath. Well, diseases as diverse as lung cancer, gut cancers, and malaria, you've now got a very strong correlation from all sorts of preclinical trials and now clinical trials between a particular breath profile and the disease. So you get about a 93% diagnosis, which for some of these conditions is fantastic. And people have been experimenting with schizophrenia and all the research going on all over the world, because people much prefer to give a breath sample. They don't use something as simple as this. They use a bigger device. But effectively, the breath is collected, and it's as data processing and data handling has become more sophisticated, it's become possible to normalize the variation in human beings, in normal breath, and distinguish how you identify the disease state. See, this is a lovely professor in Oregon, and he managed to get funding from his from some university body or other for researching the VOCs in whale breath as a means of identifying their diet and how well fed they are. And so he was in Oregon, so he used to take trips out on the Pacific, go and find his humpback whales and hang around over them trying to catch their breath. Water contamination. I'm just going to whiz through some of these now. Monitoring around a landfill site or mapping a city. You can get a lot of these monitors in a kind of passive mode. And you can put 200 of them across Bristol, for example, and find out where the pollution hotspots are. Here's the same with underground pollution. So this was a real industrial site, and there'd been underground solvent and fuel storage tanks on site. And in this case, there are soil probes, the metal probe in the picture, that are hammered into the ground, and they create basically an airspace. And you can then put one of the samplers, again in a passive mode, inside it. Just leave them all for 24 hours and you get a grid of the pollution hotspots. And actually then, it's only relative, but that's what they were interested in. Where is the pollution leaked and where is the underground water taking the plume of pollution to? And then they just take all that soil away and remediate it. Oops. There's been a huge growth recently in... Has anybody heard of the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive? Right. So it's one of the really sensible and well-thought-out laws, which basically says a building has to be neutral, you know, minimise the loss of energy to try and reduce climate change. basically, as an impact. Old buildings, that's hopeless. This one would be completely hopeless. But that, you know, the aim is for new builds. Now, what that means, this was all done with wonderful intention, but what that means is, whereas an old house, you might have 2 air changes an hour, in a new small flat, you might have 0.2, even 0.1 air change an hour. Now, what that means is that materials you used to use indoors, like carpeting, or lino, or bedding, or toys, or anything that used to be fine in a 1930 semi, are not fine in a London flat, in a tiny modern flat. And it was, you know, I've met several housing association friends of mine running, building, and they've tried to get this right, but of course they're all having to conform to the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive. And they didn't know about this air change rate 10 years ago. They do now. So everything from decorative products, cleaning products, toys, electronic equipment, construction products, everything can be a source of chemicals. Do you remember Hurricane Katrina? And incidentally, it's not just man-made products. Sometimes man-made products can be so well controlled, they now have no emission, basically. But when Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans, they needed a lot of emergency housing very fast. So they brought in a lot of cheap trailers. And the cheap trailers were partitioned with MDF. More than one person died overnight just because of the formaldehyde coming out of the MDF. So unless this is tipped, now that's an extreme example. Incidentally, Napoleon is said to have been killed by his wallpaper. So that is the earliest example, known example of people being, because it was had a lot of arsenic in it. Different issue. But you learn all sorts of interesting things. So there is should be a little pot going around. I might not have had one. Anyway, those sorts of samples can just be put in chambers. Now, this is a little diddly chamber, but you can get chambers that you can drive a whole car in. They simulate an indoor environment, or they simulate cooking, and you can then get a profile of the chemicals in whatever it is you're looking at. So here's what a strawberry looks like. Now, if you're a grower of strawberries, a big grower of strawberries, or a big importer of strawberries, you want to know the quality's right, you want to know the actual subspecies, the variety of strawberry you're getting is the right one, you want to know that it's ripe or at the right stage of ripeness. All of that information is buried in this fancy chromatogram. You can imagine the level of software you need to sort of salt the wheat from the chaff. But it's very important to the perfume business, to the spice market, that they're using authentic, and that the cheap copies there are now are distinguishable from what they charge £100 for. So this is a mushroom powder. Okay, so I've just tried to give you a flavour. I'm sorry it was a bit of a movie, but I've tried to give you a flavour of the science and what it's used for. So what about the business side? So we've said enough about this. We started our own business in 1997. And we didn't want to be honest. We were not natural entrepreneurs, and we were two of us. But two others took the risk. We couldn't afford to pay them. We couldn't afford to pay ourselves. We couldn't afford to pay them. So they were two engineers that had been laid off by our previous employer. And we all took the risk together to design a new instrument. And we started by just making and selling the tubes, the sampling tubes. And that was good for what's called cash flow. so we could get cash coming in quickly. We were busy designing, the engineers were busy working, software engineer, mechanical engineer with huge experience, were busy designing the first instrument. And we'd originally planned to work with our old employer, but that they decided against it in the end, which made it even more scary. But we've now got about 6 complementary product lines and about 200 people. Sometimes it's just as scary, especially, you know, it's difficult economically at the minute, so it is scary. But we just thank God for his help literally every single step of the way. So what do we do? Well, a company like ours has to start literally from a blank sheet of paper. So it's fantastic for engineers, software engineers, mechanical engineers, scientists like me, who actually can see what the customer wants and needs, what the next regulation is going to need them to do, what the new requirements are going to be. So you have to design it, you have to make and test the prototypes, you have to make sure it will do what you hoped it would do. So you have to test it like mad and keep all that information to show other people what it will do. Then you have to get it from engineering, which is a bit handcrafted cottage industry type of thing, into production, where it must not be anything to do with handcrafted. You know, it's got to be the same every time. Good solid supply chain, all the commercial aspects, the price, the margin, competitive issues, and then it gets launched onto the market. You have to train all your salespeople and your service people. So it's a huge deal. You know, it's a big investment. You can imagine how long that takes for a new machine. Takes usually 2 to 3 years, so it's a major, major investment. But it has driven the technology and the science, which enables other people to get better science from their research and tests. So this is, any of you, I don't suppose any of you are thinking of going into sales. If any of you were, don't be scared. I can't speak for selling double glazing. I'm sure that's terrible. But for selling something where you have to be as much of a specialist in your field as the person you're talking to is a specialist in theirs, then it is really becomes a partnership. And you're working together to get that scientist the right equipment to do their job. And that might mean saying, well, we can't help you. It sometimes does mean saying we can't help you. So I'll skip that. So I've been busy, and we have 4 children, and we've got 11 grandchildren. I've been very busy, busy with the business. We were saved, our sanity was saved by having a 3-year-old when we started the business who refused to allow us to talk work at home. But God had plans the whole time. So I'd kept my church going constant. And it was ups and downs, of course it was. And I had Anglican roots. My family were nominal Anglican, and my mother and father then did start going back a bit more. And so that was where I started. And then as I became a kind of teenager and young adult, I moved more into the evangelical world. But I started to get more and more doubts and concerns crept in. Now bear in mind, this is probably 35 years ago. And at that time, in the evangelical church, I hope it's gone now, I don't come across it in my there was a very peculiar attitude to women, certainly women leading, and even women working. And I was thinking, are they sure? I spent 4 years in America, and I couldn't square in my head right-wing Christian. Right-wing Christian with the Jesus I knew in the Bible. And that one, I still can't. I still can't join the person I see in the Bible, in Scripture, that I know, with the doctrine that's pushed by right-wing conservative Christianity. Six-day creationism, and this was almost probably the last straw. This doctrine, and it was strong in the States, obviously, but it was also strong in South Wales. There are pockets of it, believe me, that are very strong in this country, where I was told multiple times to be a proper Christian. I couldn't be a proper Christian if I didn't believe in six-day creationism. And it is still a thing. You know, there is a magazine called Creation or something. And it has a distribution of about 1 million a month. And then I think probably all of us will have struggled with this one. Should I be in full-time ministry? As a Christian, should I commit to God fully? How can I commit to God fully without being in full-time ministry? This is something else that probably we've all struggled with, is the judgmental. If you ask anybody outside the church what their perception of the established church is, and it won't be love. That will not be the answer you get, unfortunately. So, my salvation started to come, or my answer, some answer started to come with the royal law. So, love your God, love the Lord your God, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. And it was the with all your mind that suddenly, just one day, it was like a road to Damascus. It hit me between the eyes. I had one of those. I had a brain. I was going to use it for God and face some of these things. So I began to read more widely. Now, having a career, as I explained to you, I'd loved reading as a child, and I hadn't done any for years, not since I left university probably. And I began to read on the subject. I was introduced by a lovely Christian friend to Lee Abbey, to the Science and Faith courses, and they introduced me in turn to Christians in Science. And this is only about 12 years ago, and the Science and Religion Forum, and I discovered there was a world of Christians out there who didn't believe that you had to believe in the six-day creation to be a Christian. Oh, I was like... So, and then I carried on reading, more and more reading, once I'd been pointed in the right direction. So I'm now just going to finish off by very quickly going through those things I was struggling with and how the way God shaped me through business, through my science, and through faith has allowed me to wrestle. I haven't got to the end, you'll see. So being a working woman, as I said, is not an issue now, but if anyone ever gives any of you any grief about this, then the best answer by far is the epilogue in Proverbs, a wife of noble character. Here is a woman who gets up before it's light. She leaves her servants in charge of the children. She does at least three jobs while her husband lounges about. And she is a wife of noble character, a ruby, a jewel. I found it actually quietens everybody down once you mention all that. And she didn't just weave cloth, no, on some sort of hand loom, no. She was a trader in posh purple cloth. You didn't get that in Palestine. You had to import it and process it. And right, the full-time ministry thing, it sort of struck me again with full force one day. Actually, no, God had put me where he wanted me. Dorothy L. Sayers isn't, well, she did the Lord Peter Wimsey books, I think. She was one of the Inklings with C.S. Lewis in Oxford. And she once wrote, "The first duty of a Christian who makes tables is to glorify God by making good tables." So my job was to make good thermal desorbers. I was going to glorify God by making good thermal desorbers. And there's another Bible verse I want to give you, which is the last verse of Psalm 90, where we're encouraged to pray, "Establish the work of our hands." That is the work of our life, establish it. And the other thing which impacted me greatly was unemployment in South Wales when we started the business was dreadful. So true story, we were only, say, six in the company at the time, and we put a job ad out for one of our first production operatives. So I think we had a production manager, and now we needed somebody to help him. This is really in the beginning. We got 330 applicants from desperate people to get a job. It chokes me up, actually, thinking about it now. We used to go into schools. I think it all stopped through COVID and hasn't restarted again, to talk to year 10 about why they should, you know, motivate them about the world of work. And the best slide we ever showed them was, we showed them the list of the applicants that we got for an engineering job, 45,000 a year starting, and we showed them the applicants for this production job, 22,000 a year starting. And it was this awesome. I said, "Which pile do you want to be in? If you do your GCSEs, you can go for these jobs." So it caught their eye. Right, this is one which wrestled with me a lot, which was the six-day creation. It really helped me with the six-day creation. And understanding, yes, Scripture is the Word of God, and I've used quite a bit of it this evening. Jesus is also called in the Bible the Word. He is, you know, Jesus was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And for me as a Christian, and all of us, I'm sure, creation is very much God's doing. God literally, his thoughts became reality through the agency of Jesus. So for me, his thoughts, his words in his head, I don't mean using his, but God's words in God's head have become the creation. So the creation is a manifestation of the Word of God. Now you might own that, yes, of course it is. Well, it was like, holy moly for me. That's amazing. Of course it is. And that creation is telling us it's billions of years old. We read, as scientists, we read this Word of God that is creation. And it's telling us wonderful things about what God's like. The book Andrew mentioned is all about cooking your own universe. Do you want to cook your own universe? And how it takes 13.8 billion years, basically, to cook the sort of universe we know now. And the miracle at every point, and I use the word advisedly, of getting a universe which works as the one we know it. And again, we do all know that now. But people say, oh, there's no miracles nowadays. We are walking in one. We are walking in the most unbelievable miracle. So much so that atheist scientists come to the conclusion, blinking heck, there must be a God because, bother, I was wrong all along. You know, a lot of people have been converted by the sheer unlikelihood. The last person who taught me at Lee Abbey was minding his own business as an astrophysicist and was forced to become a Christian by the fact that he couldn't think of any other way that the universe could happen. Such a miracle for him, and he appreciated it. Okay. So I am sure that by listening to all the words of God, knowing Jesus, reading the Bible, learning as a scientist does, studying seriously the creation, you get the most complete picture of who God is, a most complete understanding. Right, this is a personal passion of mine, none of us are very good at the royal law, are we? None of us love God with all our heart, soul, mind and strength. None of us love other people as ourselves. So, note it doesn't say all straight people as yourself. Do you ask any gay person their experience of the church? And it'll challenge you with the royal law. Right, this is a can of worms and I am not going to open it, but suffering, I am sure science as well as the Bible gives us a wonderful insight onto suffering. Doesn't give all the answers, but you have to wrestle with the fact of how much an inherent part of any physical creation suffering is. Suffering is death and decay are built in. We are walking through the valley of death all the time. That's what creation is. That's what a physical creation is. People tend to bracket evil and suffering. I don't know why. Suffering shapes us. The Bible says so, and we know that from our experience. Somehow, if you're reading scripture, suffering plays a part in salvation. God talks about the groaning of creation. Paul talks about the groaning of creation. We hear about individual suffering and God's own suffering. Jesus, it says, was made perfect through suffering. You know, it's still a mystery probably to all of us. But I think if you look at science and scripture, you get more glimpses of what might be happening. So, thank you. That's it. The last slide is my shameless plug. Okay? So this is Hodder's posh photograph of the book. So they have got the wretched things. They just haven't sent... They've sent them to everybody. Apparently they've got this group and that group. They forgot the author. So I was a bit miffed. Anyway, it's written a bit like Horrible Histories. So it's for key stages 2 and 3. So from about, depending on the child, between 8 and 13, 14... It's funny, and the idea is, if a, at least it's as funny as I could make it. And it does cover from the Big Bang, from doing the plan through the Big Bang, inflation, the formation of stars, the creation of the elements, this was my bit. And it was not done just by yours truly. So the illustrator is a fantastic guy called Patrick Laurent. All wonderful cartoons in it. And Faraday helped me. Actually, the group in CIS Bristol helped me hugely as well. And then Faraday helped me by basically arm-twisting astrophysicists, geologists, you know, every scientist they had, and theologian, to make sure the science is really good. And I can say that without showing off, because I just did the chemistry. Okay, so it's coming out on the 8th of June, and it's available everywhere. So Waterstones, Smiths, Google, Amazon, everywhere.
Anyway, it was a wonderful talk, and it covered a lot, and I found it really fascinating. And I'm sure there'll be some questions. So, Tina has got one straight away. Tina, can you use the mic there? That was not working well. Well, I'll tell you what, use this one.
Yes, there is, and yes, it was, but it's not using our technology. Our technology is used for volatile and semi-volatile, so they've got to have a vapor pressure, basically. Novichok is almost totally non-volatile, which is why it's only contact. If you notice, they put it on the door handle, things like that. But they will have, at Porton Down, they will have analysed it using different technologies, probably liquid chromatography. To be honest, I don't know which analysis method they used. And they will be able to, what they call, forensicate it, which means map out from the contaminants in it, normally, where its source was. But it's not difficult in the case of Novichok, because it's only made in Russia. So it doesn't require Agatha Christie to solve that.
Other questions? Let me just ask a similar thing. There was a case recently of the woman who could detect Parkinson's, yes, way before anybody else could. Has that now been moved into a test using your sort of equipment?
Well, it means it's got potential to. And as you see, it's quite true that there's a lot of apocryphal and true stories of people's pets, dogs especially, barking because they can smell there's something wrong with their owner's arm or something, because they can smell something different about the biochemistry of the person. And so it's yes, but only time will tell, because the thing about some people's noses and dogs' noses, animal noses especially, is they are fantastically sensitive. So it really depends, as the technology evolves, but it really depends on what the compounds are found to be. But basically, they've got proof now for several gut cancers, which are very important, because they're almost with no symptoms. The symptoms are very generic, people feeling a bit sick, especially esophageal cancer. And if it's not caught really early, the prognosis is invariably bad. So the Institute's doing this, a lot of work, it's Imperial, a lot of work in a couple of private companies, but it is super expensive. You know, the big pharmaceutical companies spend hundreds of millions of pounds before a product reaches the market, and ultimately any medical diagnostic is subject to that. So the funding requirement is huge. So it's been about 30 years so far, and it's definitely, there is something in it, but there's very few examples which have been proven to the extent where you've got enough data to rely on, that they're going even into field trials.
You said that when you were in America, you became conservative or like Bible Christianity. I wonder if you, did you find a church that was closest to sort of liberal Christianity that you were comfortable with?
Locally, we were in Connecticut, and I suppose yes is the answer, but it was very troubled church for the other reasons. A lot of very bad witness in terms of things like the PCC equivalent, and backfighting, and you know, so it was troubled from those point of views. But the you can see a lot of concerns. Now, having said all that, there's an awful lot of good things, but so many churches aren't even affiliated to any other church, you know, which I always think is, so you can, if you don't, not very careful, people can go off the rails following one minister or, so, this was a long time ago now, and it might all have changed. So we came back in 97. So we were there from 93 to 97. So we went 30 years ago. So, but we weren't in the deep south. For books, you mean?
Well, but also for these clever gadgets.
For the clever gadgets. So books, yes. There's about five written, but Hodder have taken a big business risk. You know, this is a new area, science and faith for children. You can probably count on one hand the books that are out there, so they don't know if they're going to sell any. So that's why you must all buy one. But yes, and actually, I would love to work on some funny, if you like, new parables for adults, young adults, any adults. And I've got some ideas for that, and some of them are being crystallised, but work is all-consuming at the moment. It is as challenging economically as I've ever known it in our trade. If people can put off buying a £100,000 instrument for 2 years, they will at the moment. And so it's really challenging times. We are holding our heads above water. I must admit, it requires constant prayer and reminders. Yes, we will be able to pay everybody at the end of the month, and we always have, you know, but it's very challenging. So it kind of focuses you on the day-to-day, I'm supposed to say. We do have plans, and we've got these six product lines now from a niche mass spectrometer, but what the world needs more and more of is to be able to interpret the data. You can imagine from some of these super sensitive machines, you might get 1,000 pieces of information on different chemicals, and you don't want that. Nobody wants that. You might want it if you're a PhD doing that, and you want to spend your whole PhD on one chromatogram. But people normally, they want to look at that 1,000, and they want to look at 1,000 others and compare the one they've just got and see, is it significantly different, or is it within the normal range, for example. Or is it a good one? Is it a bad one? Do lots of new work coming up, new applications all the time. You know, recycled plastics, there's another very well-meaning bit of legislation that we have to do. You know, more and more things are now requiring 20% recycled plastic content, 30%, and so on. But recycled plastics, if you don't watch it, stink. People don't want their pop bottles smelling of something horrible. They don't want their sofa, you know, smelling bad in their living room. So the polymer industry are responding with more and more measurement, but the processing of these recycled chemicals actually requires the analysis to be online, the data to be online, so that the process can be adjusted en route, because they don't want to end up with, you know, 1,000 tons of stuff they can't use. So, and the regulations are constantly evolving. Those are the developments. Hydrogen fuels, there's another one. Lithium batteries. There's all sorts of outgassing things from these that... So those are the things that we're watching.
Yeah, so the person then, I'm told that hydrogen is hard to detect, and oxygen. So I think when we try to find an instrument to measure how much hydrogen, percentage of hydrogen we have. And it's not hydrogen oxygen, but it's very rare, so we can't tell you that.
No, GC is not used for those. That's right. But there's perfectly good technologies that are. So there are actually that answer is our sort of GC. So your organic chemistry. We're used for organic chemistry. There's a couple of exceptions. Nitrous oxide is an exception. SF6, the tracer gas, is another exception. But for the most part, the permanent gases, they're done a lot by GC, but they're done by special gas analysis systems with special, rather old-fashioned packed columns, because that's what works. Or they use spectroscopic techniques. So this could just be literally a beam of light. No, usually UV or fluorescence or infrared even. Yeah, it depends what matrix you're monitoring. So yes, you can monitor permanent gases. That's not actually a problem at all, but you wouldn't use our sort of technology.
Could you explain why hydrogen would work in vacuum chromatography?
I think that's a technical question.
I will... At our next Brinklings, okay. I will at our next Brinklings.
This is one last, yeah. One last question.
I wanted to ask you if you were kind of worried about the American electric car versus the others. I've already said on that, but I believe the university expects people taking students to be able to declare the function in their house being very close to 1950, I think. So there are two points I want to ask here. I'm going to like to die from a fire on the sofa in my bedroom, or from the chemicals in the new sofa in my bedroom. And the other thing is, which of my cars is safe? My modern car, which is 25 years old, or my old car, which is 86 years old?
That's easy, the 86-year-old one. But the 25-year-old one will be fine now as well, because we're talking about volatile organic chemicals. And, you know, again, the clue is in the name. So it will have largely... That said, if you have an oak beam from 1652 in your living room, it will still be emitting formaldehyde. It is amazing how long these things come out. Your first question was about... the sofas. Right, so regulation works, and the things that happen now, sometimes it's not even a regulation, it can just be that somebody starts it commercially. So for example, B&Q drove a lot of this, and they said, we're going to test all our paints independently, and we're not going to sell anything that is high solvent. And then Homebase thought, oh, bother. And they were losing customers to being used. So commercial pressures can also drive. Anyway, the answer is labelling. So your CE mark now on a modern sofa will almost certainly, for most indoor products, involve testing for chemical emissions. And they will have to give you an A+ or a B or a whatever it is rating. And some of that will be to do with the chemicals coming out. So it's products are certified that they are no emission. Some of the worst things were inflatable beds. You know, the old-fashioned Lilos. Oh, really not nice at all, especially when you think children were often sleeping on them, say for 12 hours or whatever. Throw them away would be my honest answer.
Well, that's a fascinating way of and really, thank you so much. There are lots of interesting things. I'm sure we could go on for a long time, but we're very grateful, and to see how you've linked your faith, your science, your commercial side, and children's books. So thank you very much.